What was Ezra? What was his task? What kind of work did he do? A scribe. What is a scribe? What? Okay, he studied and taught the law. He was a man of letters. The word scribe has to do with writing, so he was a man who studied the law and taught the law. A skillful teacher. That's what it came to be known as in the Old Testament. And we'll see that when we get a little bit further in the book in chapter 7. But that's what he was, all right? And does the first six chapters talk about, or do the first six chapters talk about Ezra's work? No, they do not. Chapter 7 begins to talk about his return to Jerusalem and the work that he did. So the first six chapters talk about what? The what?
Return to
the promised land. To do
what?
To rebuild. To rebuild what?
The temple.
The return to the promised land to rebuild the temple. Now, we asked that question that way with more details because there was another return for another purpose led by another man. Who is that?
Nehemiah.
And his return, he came back for what purpose? Rebuild the walls. That's right. And that was some time later. All right, so we're reading about the first return. And we studied in our classes, the two classes thus far, that this return, the impetus behind it was a decree by King. Who? Cyrus, right. Persian king. And we see God's providence working in the kingdoms of men to bring about his purposes. We talked about that in our classes. Now, we ended our class on verse 5 of chapter 1 with a question. I don't know if you thought about when you were studying going back and looking at the answer to that question, but we just noticed a phrase there in chapter 1. Verse 5, when he starts talking about the people who are going to return from Babylon, the way Ezra writes it is this: Then the heads of the fathers' households of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and the Levites arose, even everyone whose spirit God stirred to go up and rebuild the house of the Lord which is in Jerusalem. We asked the question at the end of our last class, what does it mean, or how did God stir up their spirit? Was this some kind of direct influence on their hearts? Some better felt than told experience? What does it mean God stirred up their hearts? And we suggested at the end of class that the answer to that question is earlier in the chapter. I don't know if that was a good tip or a bad tip, but the providence of God. Earlier in the chapter, we've been talking about Cyrus, and you look back in chapter 1, and verse 1, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus. That is, providentially. Now, I don't know exactly how he did that. I don't know if Cyrus read Isaiah's prophecy. Isaiah wrote about Cyrus 160 years earlier. Josephus, a Jewish historian, says that he did. I don't know if that's reliable or not. We talked about the fact that Daniel was a prophet working among the kings. Maybe it was through the influence of Daniel. I don't know. But in some way, God provided providence for Cyrus to have this desire to set these exiles free to return to their homeland and to rebuild the temple of their God. And so when you get down to verse 5 and you read God's the spirit of people that God stirred up, don't read into that something that's not there. We read about things being done by God or the Holy Spirit or Christ, and sometimes those things are immediate, that is, they do them directly, and sometimes they are mediate, That is, they do them through means or agency. And that's true with any ruler. Over in the book of Acts, you read about a civil ruler who provided for robbers to be removed from the land. Not that he went out and arrested anybody, but he provided for it. He caused it to happen. And so this is not critical in this particular passage, but recognizing that kind of language will be helpful when you're studying passages, for example, in the New Testament. It talks about God doing something in the hearts of people, not to read into that, that God directly sent them some kind of a vision or an experience or something like that. That providentially that can be done either through teaching or other people's influence or a string of events, however God may cause that to happen. So we were reading in verse 5 through the end of chapter 1 about the departure from Babylon of these exiles. And so we'll pick up here in verse 6. All those about them encouraged them with articles of silver, with gold, with goods, with cattle, and with valuables, aside from all that was given as a freewill offering. In the marginal note on the word encouraged, if you have the New American Standard, it says strengthen their hands. And so although not everyone returned, others were encouraging them in their work. That's a good thing. And we can do a similar thing today about the gospel being preached in Italy. How is that? That's right. Do we strengthen Brother Berdini's hands when we contribute to his needs, to his support, or to Vicente Ramirez, or to Emilio Acevedo in Chile? Certainly. And so we can encourage others, not only by words, but in this particular case, they gave gifts to help them in the work that they were attempting to do when they got back. We're going to read later in the book of Ezra about some men who should have been encouraging them in their work, but actually their actions were would have been negative. And we'll see that because of the work of two prophets. But we talked about the value of Old Testament Bible study, and we read in 1 Corinthians 10 that there are some examples that are not to be followed that Paul appealed to. Then we read in Romans 15 that there is encouragement and instruction in the Old Testament for us today. And we'll see both sides of that in the book of Ezra as we study. Okay? And then also King Cyrus brought out the articles from the house of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken away from Jerusalem and put in the house of his gods. And Cyrus, king of Persia, had them brought out by the hand of Mithridates, the treasurer, and he counted them out to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. We ask you a question on your sheet. What is another name for Sheshbazzar? Zerubbabel. And you can establish that. You look at chapter 5 and verse 16. It says Sheshbazzar came and laid the foundation of the house. And then we turn over to the prophet Zechariah in chapter 5. And chapter 4 and verse 9, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation. Now, why is the testimony of Zechariah called here, for example? Is there something particular as to how Zechariah would have a knowledge and a bearing on knowing what went on here? That's right. Zechariah was sent to encourage them to finish the work. We read about that over, if you turn over to chapter 5, when the prophets Haggai and Zechariah. So although they occur later in your Bible, they came and prophesied during this period. And so we see that oftentimes men had different names. Sheshbazzar was likely the Chaldee name for Zerubbabel. Remember that Daniel was given other names as well, and you find as well as his three friends. And to what office was he appointed according to chapter 5, verse 14 in Haggai 1:1? Governor. All right. Who was the king over Israel? Who was the Israelite king at this time?
Pharaoh.
Nobody knows his name?
There wasn't one.
That's right. They had no more kings once they were taken captive, did they? Until the king would arise, which is, of course, the Messiah. That's right. So, just a governor. They're still under Persian dominion at this time. Okay. We move into chapter 2. Who wants to volunteer to read all those names? All right. Chapter 2 is a list of those who returned. We suggested that you go back and look at your synopsis. That's what chapter 2 is about. The list of those who return. So we start in chapter 2, verse 1. Now these are the people of the province who came up out of the captivity of the exiles, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away to Babylon and returned to Jerusalem and Judah, each to his city. How much time approximately had passed between the time that Nebuchadnezzar had taken people captive to what we're talking about here? When was the first time that Nebuchadnezzar took people captive? About 605, and this is approximately what? This return?
536.
So about how many years in between that? About 70. Who talked about that?
Daniel.
Daniel, and he read it where?
In Jeremiah.
That's right. And so here's the end of that 70-year period of captivity. It also can be dated from the year the temple was destroyed in 586 until the temple was completed in 516. Okay? So here these people are returning, just like God promised, through Jeremiah the prophet. That's maybe a rather remarkable thing in view of the fact they didn't have a protest. They didn't raise an army. It was through the edict of a heathen king that God accomplished his purpose and kept his word. And we see the sureness of God's promises and the validity of Jeremiah as a prophet. Okay, so these came with Zerubbabel, and then we had this word Jeshua, and on your list, on your questions here, number 2, this Jeshua, if he's the same person as Haggai 1:1, what is he called there?
Joshua.
He was the high priest, wasn't he? And that further confirmed in Ezra chapter 3, verse 2 and 3, where you read about him, Jeshua the son of Josadak and his brothers the priest. And so he was a priest, and if he's the same one as Haggai 1, he's the high priest. And so Zerubbabel the leader, and that's why we put on your sheet here, chapter 2, verse 2, the leaders. Zerubbabel the leader, and then Jeshua, and then these other names. Now this Nehemiah that you read here is not the Nehemiah of the book of Nehemiah. That's quite later. And then this Mordecai that you read here, if it's the Mordecai of Esther 2:5, he must have later returned to Babylon, because that's where we find him in the book of Esther. So I don't know that it is or not. It's certainly not certain. Okay, just some observations about two or three of those names that might be of interest. And so then we have, beginning in verse 3 down through verse 35, the various heads of families that are recorded there. I'm going to mention something just in passing. We're not going to spend any time on it. But it may be in you're talking with someone or you're reading something critical of the Bible as if it was faulty, that you'll run across, or you may even read it in a commentary. You may not have observed this, but you'll see down in verse 64, the whole assembly numbered 42,360. I doubt hardly any of us took the time to total the figures that are given beginning in verse 3, total them separately. Just add them up. But if you add them up, they do not come out to 42,360. Come out to 29,818. Why the difference? There's three possibilities that I see. I do not know which is the correct one, if any of these three. But there is an accounting that's different here, and the Jewish people of that day saw no problem with it. They were there. And so whatever it was not a discrepancy, at least in their minds. But nevertheless, we see, and by the way, Nehemiah also gives that total, same total that you read here in the book of Ezra. One possibility is that this list principally deals with Judah and Benjamin, not the other people of the other tribes who return. Look over in chapter 6 and verse 17, however. How many male goats were offered when the temple was dedicated? 12. One for each tribe. While principally Judah and Benjamin are being discussed, there are people from the other tribes evidently that return. Look in chapter 8 and verse 35. Once again, you see 12 male goats for a sin offering. And there are indications in the book of Kings that in the reign of Hezekiah and Josiah, there was a remnant from the 12 tribes that were left in the land. Although Assyria had come in and conquered the northern kingdom, there was a remnant of some of those tribes left in the land, evidently that were still interested in serving God because of Hezekiah's appeal to them and Josiah's appeal to them and them partaking in these particular feasts that these men, these kings, had during their reign. So that's one possibility. Second possibility, I was in a class one time teaching this, and an older fellow who was a good Bible student suggested this. He said, it says in verse 1, it's the list of those who were carried away. And so that this list only would include the older men, not the younger. In other words, it had to be at least 50 years old. And I don't know if that's correct or not, but that's certainly a possibility. And then third, it's that it's the list of men and it doesn't include the women. That was not uncommon among the Jews because they were concerned about lineage, about land ownership, about priesthood. We'll see more about that in just a moment. Not that the women were important, but for the genealogical records, that may be the case as well. I don't know which one of the three of those. Maybe there's a better explanation. I don't know. But I simply mention that so that if you run across that, do not be upset, do not be disturbed by that. There is a difference. It's not. There's no effort by Ezra to hide it. There's no indication in any of the Jewish writings or literature that this was a problem. And so it was not a problem, and whatever the reason was, it was understood. All right, now we get down to verse 36 through 39, and what does he list there? The priest. And you'll know he only lists his four courses. Originally, if you go back to 1 Chronicles 24, there were 24 courses of priest. And I suppose as a result of the captivity, the many were slain, those who were taken captive, maybe others lost. As far as their genealogy, there's only four courses. Alfred Edersheim, who did a lot of writing about Jewish history, and I don't know how reliable this is, he said that each one of these four chose five more of the priests, and so they brought it back up to the 24 courses. I don't know if that's correct or not, but nevertheless, you read about only four where there were originally 24. Of course, when the people came into the Promised Land the first time, how many people were there? Was there ever a census taken to find out? Was there? Yeah, book of Numbers. Two times, right? Beginning of the book, the end of the book. 38 years in between. And in that census that was taken, of what kind of people? 20 years old and upward, they were able to go to war. And there's an example, by the way, of a census being done on the men and not all the men. The soldiers. So if there were 600 and something thousand soldiers, how big was the nation? If 80 or 90% of those people had wives and they had children, it's estimated, you know, maybe 2, 3 million people, maybe more. How many are returning this time? Less than 50,000. But when the priesthood was set up, you had 24 courses, now you have four courses, and so that would be a corresponding as far as the number of people that returned the first time and the number of the people that returned this time. are all priests Levites under the Old Testament law? No? Who's not? I thought they were. Are all Levites priests?
No.
That's why Brock, he was ahead of me. But not all Levites were priests. That's right. Because you had to be descended of Aaron and his sons, right? So what's the next group here that you have listed in beginning in verse 40 through 42? The Levites. So it's a broader span, a broader scope than 40 through 42. And then of the Levites, you have three divisions, and we've already put that on your sheet. You have the assistants of the priests in divine worship in verse 40, the singers in verse 41, and the gatekeepers in verse 42. So they were assigned different tasks to help there in the temple and the worship of the temple, those kind of things. All right, so you can read about that in the earlier books of the Old Testament. In verse 43 through 54, I went ahead and took care of Sally. I put Nethinim on there so she wouldn't say Nethinims. Or anybody else that uses the New King James, Nethinim. That's the way it's translated in the King James and New King James. Nothing wrong with that. Or the American Standard. But many of the other versions, instead of using the word Nethinim, just tell you what that word means, which is what? Temple servants. They're temple servants. Did things around the temple, served in various other capacities. And so they're listed. And then in verse 55 through 58, you have Solomon's servants. In verse 59 through 63, we'll talk some more about that in just a moment. You have those who could not trace their genealogy. And then in verse 60, and that he first of all deal with the families and the priests. We're going to talk about the priests more here in just a moment. And then the sum totals in verse 64 through 69, the sum total of the people in 64, the animals in 66, and the gifts in 68. And then in verse 70, just kind of a summary statement of the chapter. So that's essentially what chapter 2 is about. Now, you see that when they, verse 1, each one returned to his city. And we look at chapter 2, maybe we're reading the book of Ezra, and we say, I'll just skip this. Why is this important if you lived then? What's one reason it would be important?
Inheritance.
The inheritance. Land was allotted to the various tribes and tracing, being able to trace your genealogy. And that's why when you get down to verse 59, they were not able to give evidence of their father's household and their descendants, where they were of Israel. But even more so is when you get to the priest. Verse 61, the sons of the priests. In verse 62, these searched among their ancestral registration, but they could not be located. So what? Here's the so what. Therefore, they were considered unclean and excluded from the priesthood. The governor said to them they should not eat from the most holy things until priests stood up with a Urim and Thummim. What we ask you on the sheet here, that's first mentioned, those two items are first mentioned in Exodus chapter 28 and verse 30. And then we gave you, besides Ezra 2, gave you two other places there mentioned. These verses are sufficient to see at least what these were used for. What were they used for?
Do the next one.
I'm not going to say that's wrong, but usually a divination we associate with idolatry. Can you? Sally said divination. That's not wrong if you depend on how you define it.
To seek judgment from God
in special circumstances. The leaders of the people would seek some intervention by God in special circumstances. That's what you have in Numbers 27. That's what you have in 1 Samuel 28. And what these actually were, what they actually looked like, we don't know. What happened to them, we don't know. And you can see here, they didn't have them. And so this question could not be answered. And as a result, these people who couldn't trace their genealogy, maybe they had the right genealogy, but if they couldn't prove it, they couldn't serve, right? I have here in my hand a book. This is an inspired book, by the way. Or at least that's what they claim. In fact, there's two here. One's called Doctrine and Covenants, and one's called The Pearl of Great Price. Anybody familiar with what those are? Mormons. Mormons is so-called inspired work, supposed to be. I'm going to read from the Doctrine and Covenants. Now, you see what you just read right here, okay? One of the pillars to Mormonism, and I've had a lesson I've had kind of in the wings, I'm going to preach one of these days, keep looking at it, but I hadn't decided when, and it deals with this. One of the pillars to Mormonism is the idea of priesthood. And I'm reading from this Doctrine and Covenants, section 68, number 15. Wherefore they shall be high priests who are worthy, and they shall be appointed by the first precedency of the Melchizedek priesthood, except they be literal descendants of Aaron. Now I go down a little further. It says, but as a high priest of the Melchizedek priesthood has an authority to officiate in all the lesser offices, he may officiate in the office of bishop when no literal descendant of Aaron can be found, provided he is called and set apart and ordained into this power under the hands of the first presidency of the Melchizedek priesthood. So he's saying, the high priest of Melchizedek could function in the duties of the Aaronic priesthood, even though he could not trace his lineage. What about Mr. Smith, who founded the Mormon Church? Supposedly he saw a vision, and in this vision, he was told, I confer the priesthood of Aaron, which holds the keys of the ministering of angels and of the gospel of repentance and of baptism by immersion for the remission of sins, and this shall never be taken again from the earth until the sons of Levi do offer again an offering unto the Lord in righteousness. It says, I laid my hands upon his head and ordained him to the Aaronic priesthood, and afterward he laid his hands on me and ordained me to the same priesthood. And so forth. What do you read here? How can you serve in the Aaronic priesthood? What's absolutely essential? Genealogical records. They don't have them. They admit they don't have them. Oh, special vision. They're accepted. Really? Look at Hebrews chapter 7. Christ was of what order, priesthood? Melchizedek. And then there was the order of Aaron under the old law. So let's begin here in verse 11 of Hebrews 7. Now, if perfection was through the Levitical priesthood, for on the basis of it the people received the law, what further need was there for another priest to arise according to the order of Melchizedek and not be designated according to the order of Aaron? For when the priesthood is changed, what's necessary? Change of the law. Got to change the law. Now, for the one concerning whom these things are spoken belongs to another tribe, from which no one has officiated at the altar. What's his argument? If no one's officiated at the altar, And he says in verse 14, Moses spoke nothing about anybody from the tribe of Judah officiating. What's the conclusion about such a person? Can they officiate? Not under the law of Moses. There had to be a change of law. So a law was changed. A new law came into place, the law of Christ. No longer the Aaronic priesthood. Christ is of the priesthood of Melchizedek. How many predecessors?
None.
How many successors?
None.
None. That's it. So it's your choice. Is this the Word of God? Or is this the Word of God? And so this, what you're reading here in Ezra 2 has a very practical bearing on religious views today. Okay? Any other questions or comments about chapter 2? Okay, we'll go to chapter 3. I'm sorry. That's an interesting comment Linda makes in her discussion with some Jewish friends in New Jersey. They acknowledged that they have no genealogical records to prove priesthood. But if there's no priesthood, can you have a national Israel? You cannot. Now, you read in the news about national Israel, but that's simply civil and political. It's not the national Israel you read about in the Bible. You can't have one without a priesthood. That was an integral part of that nation. So here, when the temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, a lot of the genealogical records were lost, but some at least were able to be found. But in A.D. 70, when the temple was destroyed, no genealogical records after that. Without genealogical records, no priesthood, no national Israel. And yet preachers are preaching on radio and TV all the time that God is going to restore national Israel. He's still got a plan for national Israel. We've got a problem. And that's pointed to right here in this Old Testament book. So very practical uses of reading the book of Ezra and seeing what these people were up against during their day. Okay, chapter 3. Anyone need chapter 3? I've got some chapter 3s here. Anyone else? Did I overlook anyone? Okay. Good point Sally makes. He did fulfill those. He made three promises in Genesis 12. One had to do with the land. Joshua said he fulfilled it, didn't he? One had to do with the nation, which he fulfilled that in the nation of Israel. One had to do with the Messiah, which was fulfilled when Christ came. That's a good point that Sally makes. We don't need the Levitical priesthood anymore. We don't need the Aaronic priesthood anymore. God fulfilled His promises. On chapter 3, we had given you a section there on that first lesson. We encourage you to hold on to that because you'll be referring back to it throughout the course of our study. We had a synopsis of each of the chapters there. And so if you have that copy with you and you look back on that of chapter 3, what is chapter 3 about? We divide it into two sections. What's the first section? Okay, that's right. The altar is erected and they offer offerings or sacrifices or burnt offerings on it. That's the first 7 verses. And then what's the second section? Foundation of the temple is laid. I don't know if it's helpful to you. It's helpful to me. When I go back, if I've got some notations like that to kind of say, well, what's this chapter about? What am I reading about here? If I get to verse 5 or I get to verse 15 and say, oh, yes, this is the scope of this particular section. So anyway, that's why we do that, is try to help us keep the bigger picture as we go through the book. All right? Verse 1, now when the 7th month came, and you'll see down in verse 6, from the first day of the 7th month, they began to offer burnt offerings. And then in verse 8, the second year of their coming at the house of God, the 2nd month. So in the first year of their coming, in the 7th month, which would be somewhere around our October, and the 7th month would be the beginning of their civil year. They had a beginning of their religious year in the spring. This is the beginning of their civil year. The month, T-I-S-H-R-I, I believe. And so, the 7th month. Okay, now, the text does not say in verse 8, the 2nd year of Cyrus' decree. He issued the decree in his first year. When did they actually return? This does not say. This says the foundation was laid in the 2nd year of their return. So, if you remember in your summary of the dates that I gave you on the first sheet, we gave you some dates. These are approximate. You're going to find people dating these things differently. But Cyrus began his reign over, not his reign totally, but his reign over Babylon, he conquered Babylon, 539. Some will date his first year from the civil month, 538 to 537, meaning he issued a decree during that time, from the fall to the fall, and then they returned. And so did they return that year? Did it take them some time now to make preparations to return and that kind of thing? So generally, and again, you're going to see variances, 537, 536, 535, but it's going to be close. We've just used the date 536 for the laying of the foundation of the temple. Okay, so that's not written in stone, and you will find a little bit of variance about that. That's nothing to be disturbed about. We just wanted to mention that. Okay, so the dates we gave you at the beginning, at the first, is at least kind of a yardstick to get us in the ballpark of when these things are transpiring. So when the 7th month came, that'd be our September, October, that range of their return, in other words. Did they return in the spring? Very possible, because usually back then spring was traveling time, not winter. So I don't know what time of the year Cyrus issued his decree. You'll find in the book of Acts, oftentimes, the winter times were not time for traveling. The kings oftentimes would wait till the spring to go to war in the Old Testament. So it's very possible they returned in the spring, and now they're in the fall. And these procedures now began to take place, and the people come from their cities where they had went for these events that you read about here in chapter 3. The sons of men of Israel were in their cities, and the people gathered as one man to Jerusalem. That is, they were united in spirit about what was going to take place now. They had united or gathered as one man, which is a statement of unity. And Jeshua, the son of Josadak, and his brothers the priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel. It's interesting, just a passing note, if you want to really have fun and go back and read the chronological records in the first 9 chapters of 1 Chronicles. That'll challenge you. But anyway, that's what the Chronicles are. In the first 9 chapters, it lists kings and priests, etc. 1 Chronicles 3:17, it's possible that this Zerubbabel, not certain, but it's possible that he is the son of Jeconiah, a descendant, not the immediate son, a descendant of Jeconiah who was taken captive, the king who was taken captive. If he is indeed, if that Shealtiel is the one mentioned there, and he is the descendant of that king who was taken captive, you can see why it might be natural for him to be the appointed governor. But don't know that for certain. Just an interesting thing in passing. And his brothers arose and built the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it. Now here's an interesting statement. We have something about it on your lesson. But let me first of all get question number 2. The 7th month was a special month. We gave you some verses, Leviticus 23:16 and Numbers 29. What happened on the following days of the 7th month? On the first day, what happened? Feast of Trumpets. That phrase never occurs in the Old Testament. But that's what it's called. What it's actually called in Numbers 29 is a day for the blowing of trumpets. Trumpets were blown on the first day of every month. But this was a special day for blowing trumpets. And it's called the Feast of Trumpets. First of the month. So that was special. What happened on the 10th day of the month? Day of Atonement. Very, very important day. Read about that in Leviticus 16. And what happened then on the 15th of the month? Beginning of the Feast of Booths, or Feast of Tabernacles, or Feast of Ingatherings, called all three. So this was a special month. And you can see why, after they got in and got in their city, why this month would be a month that would naturally be a time for gathering back in Jerusalem to begin this work that they had went back to their homeland for. All right, we're out of time. We'll pick up right there, the Lord willing, Wednesday night.